Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is April 25th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Mill. The title of today's podcast is Tiny Bubbles, FOMED and Medical Education. And we have a guest skeptic on today's podcast, Dr. Nicholas Jean, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. Welcome to the SGEM, Nick.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So, Nick, we actually met in ASAP last year, right?
Yeah, at the social media hangout.
Yeah, you were speaking at the conference, and then we popped up together at the social media reception. As you may know, the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine is always trying to cut the knowledge translation window down from 10 years to 1 year. And it does this using, of course, social media to get the listener the best evidence that's been critically appraised and also easily accessible. And this is so people can provide the best care to emergency patients. And the weekly podcast usually does a critical appraisal of a recent paper. However, every so often, I do like to take a step back and look at the forest, not the trees. But I guess in this case, it would be the beer and not the bubbles. So it's time to sit back, relax, and discuss a medical education issue. And Nick, this is how you came to being on the program today. You did a recent pro and con debate in EP Monthly, and I think the title was Why # FOMED is not essential to emergency medicine education. You took the con side of the debate.
Yeah, it's true. And let me tell you the genesis of this piece really has to do with some of the back and forth we were having at EP Monthly, the journal that I help edit. Almost every month we get submissions from someone who has become a true believer in FOMED. You know, as the resident techie on our editorial masthead, these pitches usually come to me, and I like to, lately I've been getting kind of grumpy and I've been rejecting them. I've been saying, we don't need to run another piece about this. We don't need, our readers aren't interested in figuring out how to surf Twitter hashtags or download the latest podcasts. They've heard enough about this. And so Logan and Judy Tintinelli and other folks on our staff are saying, Nick, if you're on Twitter and you're using FOAM and you don't want to run anymore on this topic, you've got to explain why. And so that's when I sat down and started trying to write this out.
So the person they asked to provide the pro side of this, why # FOMED is essential to EM education, was Dr. Joe Lex himself. Yes, the godfather of the FOMED movement. Everyone in the FOAM community should be familiar with Joe's famous quote. Nick, what did Joe say?
If you want to know how we practiced medicine 5 years ago, read a textbook. If you want to know how we practiced 2 years ago, read a journal. If you want to know how we practiced medicine last year, go to a conference. Go to a good conference. And if you want to know how we practice medicine now and in the future, use FOMED.
Excellent. That is Joe himself. So before we start discussing FOMED, I guess we better make sure that everybody knows what we mean when we say FOMED. So do you have some kind of definition or description of what FOAM means to you?
Well, I'll just borrow the official kind of now apocryphal story. Mike Cadogan with Chris Nixon, one of the big forces behind Life in the Fast Lane, was at a bar in Dublin over a pint of Guinness. Again, that beer, the constant underpinning of all FOAM. And he coined the term free open access medication or medical education. And I don't know if it was really inspired by the time of bubbles, tiny bubbles in the Guinness beer, but that's where it came from.
Everybody has heard that story about that beer in Dublin, but FOAM stands for medical education for anyone, anywhere, at any time. If you go to the Life in the Fast Lane site, they say that FOAM should not be seen as a teaching philosophy or a strategy, but rather a global, accessible, crowdsourced educational adjunct. And it provides inline, so contextual, and offline asynchronous content to augment traditional education principles. And FOAM has one objective, and I love this objective, to make the world a better place. Wow. How could you argue with that? So now that everybody knows what FOAMED means, right? And now we can start arguing about it. Now everybody knows what FOAMED means. Then I would like to discuss the article that you wrote in your column. And you start the article, actually, Nick, by saying, what's not to like about FOAM? The price is right. It's free. It's ubiquitous. It's portable. And you even describe yourself as an enthusiastic supporter of FOAM. So talk to me about your history a bit more with social media.
Okay. Well, what the argument I made was specifically that FOAM is not essential to emergency medicine education. And if we stick with the simple definition that Mike advocates, that it's an adjunct, then I think there's no disagreement at all. Everyone likes it. And when it's treated as an adjunct, it's perfect. It's wonderful. It's efficient. It's entertaining. And it's good. The problem is when people go overboard, when they use FOAM at the exclusion of traditional means of education.
So, you know, you're saying that FOAM could be taken too far or people could overdose on it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's tempting to overdose on it because it is entertaining and it is ubiquitous and it is easily accessible. You know, weeks go by before I realize I haven't read any articles. I've just been listening to podcasts and retweeting pithy statements from people who are smart. Very tempting to fall into that trap. And then you realize that you're letting your critical thinking skills erode and hard-won knowledge that you fought for in training, could easily kind of become consumed by just the latest buzzwords and the latest discussion topics.
So I guess what you're saying then is that FOAM just should not be used exclusively, correct?
It's not essential to EM education, and when we do use it exclusively, I think we run some big risks.
Every group, of course, can have some outliers or some extremists that use everything to the exclusion of those other tools available to them. And there are individuals, of course, in the FOAM community that disregard other things, but I don't think that should dictate the usefulness of FOAM for all medical education.
I'll say that, you know, especially when you're still in training, especially in residency or in school, your time is finite. And so if you've got 2 or 3 hours to really crack open some textbooks or some journals, if you have 2 or 3 hours a week maybe to do that between your shifts and your sleeping and family and so forth, you know, you can find those 2 or 3 hours really quickly consumed by some podcasts and some time bouncing around on Twitter and reading some blogs, and you feel like you're up to date, you feel like you're getting a quality education, and you might really be learning a lot about some subspecialty, but you're doing yourself a disservice.
So you need to use it in moderation, and that any learning tool, of course, used to excess could be counterproductive to education, and people learn using different strategies, and FOAM just represents one tool that could be employed. But just because people use the tool incorrectly does not make the tool bad. I mean, a stethoscope is a great instrument for listening to the heart and lungs, and I realize it's slowly being replaced by ultrasound, but it makes a lousy reflex hammer. And again, it's not the tool, right, that I want to criticize. We should be looking at the person who's using the tool and how they're using the tool.
Sure, but let's criticize the tool a little bit too, because I don't think we do enough of that.
Okay, so what's your criticism of Twitter?
Trying to follow an academic discussion on Twitter is very difficult. Folks who say, oh, you know, hashtags make it simple, they're ignoring the fact that hashtags invite all kinds of noise and all kinds of third parties get involved and jokes are shared and people are trying to make puns and people are trying to divert your attention to something else. And honestly, I love the tweets that have a little bit of a headline, a link, maybe some commentary, and that's it. And then I follow the link and I read a nice blog article or I read a primary source, some PDF somewhere about some topic of emergency medicine education. And I realize that I'm really just using Twitter, not for the conversations, but really just as a almost like a curated list of quality resources. So I'd like to follow some smart people on Twitter and see what they're thinking about. But when I try to engage them, when we have these big free-for-all discussions, it gets very confusing and pretty frustrating.
Isn't that great? Why how social media has different platforms, though, and you just described perfectly how you use a certain part of social media, Twitter, and you use that tool effectively. And I always say that I think Twitter was made specifically for emergency physicians because it is only 140 characters, and we do tend to have short attention spans. Squirrel. But if you can't get your message across in 140 characters, then I think you need to move to a different platform to do that. And that sort of leads into the whole knowledge translation issue and problem, because there is this problem with knowledge translation, and where Twitter and hashtags and electronic media is very fast, the traditional method of knowledge translation is quite slow. And it's thought that it takes an average of 10 years for high quality, clinically relevant information to go to the patient's bedside, and that's Pathman's leaky pipe model. You mentioned in your article something about how students would be more likely to remember a podcast rather than a traditional model of teaching. And I was wondering, why is that so bad? Why is it so bad that someone listens to a podcast and then remembers that or has retention for that? How could that be worse than listening to a lecture and not remembering as much?
Oh, well, no, that's a great, I'm glad you brought that up. And a lot of our understanding of the effect of podcasts on medical education comes from your neck of the woods, Canada. Zanussi has written, I think, two or three articles now on podcasts. And so she's actually skeptical that retention is actually better with podcasts. Studies are back and forth on this, that retention can actually suffer when you have a podcast. Now, there's a lot of satisfaction surveys that say that students prefer podcasts. They prefer the video or the audio form of the podcast, and they can rewind when they don't, you know, understand something. But, I think the jury's kind of out on whether long-term retention is actually enhanced with podcasts, and I wanted to convey that in my article.
I agree. There is some conflicting evidence with regards to the effectiveness of podcasts. So because it's sort of a debatable area, I'll move on to something else. And that is, how about the quality? You had concerns about quality when it came to foam resources.
Yeah. You know, it's no problem, I think, for veterans of Twitter and veterans of podcasts. We all pick our favorites over time. We all gravitate toward the podcast that consistently impress us. I'm proud that in my department at Mount Sinai, we have Dave Newman and Scott Weingart, two of the leaders in podcasting. But for every one of those, there's, you know, some lousy wannabes out there.
I understand that criticism could, of course, be flung at all forms of medical education. There are 3,000 publications every day from hundreds of journals, and, you know, many of them suffer from poor quality. And Nick, it's not just the small niche journals, but sometimes it's these well-known high-impact journals with quality problems. And there are, of course, many other problems in the traditional sources, such as publication bias. You know, if it's a positive study, it's more likely to get published, right? And then we all have concerns of pharmaceutical involvements, paying these journals for reprints, ghost writings, and even downright academic fraud.
No argument from me. There are definitely problems. There's definitely lousy things that get past peer review. Peer review has tons of flaws. But I will say that to a neophyte who's confronted with, should I spend an hour reading the New England Journal, or should I spend an hour surfing Twitter trying to figure out who are the good people to follow? And should I spend an hour on Apple or iTunes trying to download some good medical podcasts? I think minute for minute, you're going to have more value in reading the New England Journal than trying to navigate this complex system of FOMED, especially for the neophytes.
But then it rests on us, the educators, their attendings, their teachers, actually, to have a good understanding of this and help point them to good resources. And you've mentioned a few. I mean, Scott Weingart and his podcast, David Newman with Smart EM and his podcast. It's up to us to sort of filter that for them, just like we can point them to good journals to read and trust, like you've done with the New England Journal, saying that that's something that you would recommend them spend their time doing. So, I'm going to put in a shameless plug for our method at the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, just to address the quality issue. You know, the best evidence in emergency medicine program that was started about 8 years ago out of McMaster University has been validated, and it is a reliable way to select critically appraise the literature. We screen these 3,000 articles of daily publications for emergency medicine providers. And Nick, we take the relevant articles and then we crowdsource them out to about 200 beam raters or frontline emerge docs and ask them how this particular paper would impact on their practice. And it's the ones that are highly rated from them that go through a critical appraisal process using the beam tools, which I've put up on the SGEM for people to download. And then people with expert in clinical epidemiology skills within the BEAM faculty do a critical appraisal of the paper, and then we send this to our editorial team for peer review, and it's these critical appraisals that show up as the main content in the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. So that's my shameless plug for quality when it comes to this podcast.
You know, you should be proud of this this rigorous process that you have, and that's excellent. I salute you. I don't know if people take the care and time and rigor that you do. So yeah, maybe we should do a good job publicizing what SGEM does, and on Twitter and on all the channels that are out there for social media, just keep flooding it with high quality information and hope that the good bubbles rise to the top.
Oh, I love that analogy. The good stuff bubbles up to the top. Now, the next argument in your piece was that it's difficult to reference foam when you're on shift, something about searching a podcast reference or remembering a Twitter exchange.
Oh yeah. And this might be me getting older, you know, looking back to the golden age of blogging, you know, like 6 or 7 years ago. Every ED that I've worked in now has computers everywhere that are connected to the internet. And I, like you said, a lot of us are carrying smartphones or tablets. So it should be really quick and easy to kind of access the text form of this information and kind of pass around the tablet so everyone can see that figure that you were thinking about. But instead, because so many people are experiencing FOMED on podcasts, audio only, while they're doing other stuff, they, you know, some stuff does sink in, but then when you want to regurgitate it back, it doesn't come out just right.
I agree that it can be difficult now, but a process is underway to try to address these issues. I mean, there are smart people from Life in the Fast Lane and Academic Life in Emergency Medicine who are building these databases of foam material to make it easy to search and retrieve information. And certainly data stored electronically is what computers can do well, to both store and search stuff electronically. And try to find a paper from the 1950s or a textbook reference. Often, even if you're trying to do it electronically through a citation, you're stuck with all these paywalls as well.
Yeah, the point is well taken, but I think things were actually better a few years ago when blogging was like the predominant form of FOMED at the time. And, you know, if you wanted to comment on something, you had to register and comment, and then you could see the trail of comments and follow a discussion rationally and logically, unlike today where you've got to kind of sift through a bunch of Twitter comments or follow a bunch of links to a bunch of different social sites or rewind to the right spot in a podcast. I mean, I will say this is a solved problem for a lot of the high quality podcasts where they will have a kind of text guide that they follow. So if you want to see the podcast, you can, or you want to listen to the podcast, you click play. But if you want to read what the key points are, you can just scroll down and see them. And that is nice when that is offered.
Nick, it actually is a nice lead-in, though, to your essential critique of foam. And we're getting close to the end of the podcast, and I want to make sure we touch on the essential critique that you had of foam, and that it's not a curriculum. And I was wondering if you could expand on that concept.
I think it might be inherent in the F. The F of foam is free. And I think so long as it's free, people are going to want to talk about the things that they're passionate about, the things that they're good at, the things that interest them. And they're going to want to write about those things, and they're going to want to share those things, and they're going to hear what other people have to say about those things. So it's naturally going to be the stuff that is of active research interest, whether it's, you know, critical care or ultrasound or stroke therapies or whatever's cutting edge at the time. So that's what the vast majority of FOMED tends to be. It tends to be, you know, newsworthy and buzzworthy. And so you don't see a lot of FOMED on ulnar gutter splints. You don't see a lot of FOMED on, you know, gastritis. And yet these are kind of essential things that we have to know how to handle in the emergency department. And so, again, when your residence training time is finite, when their time for education and self-directed learning is finite, they could spend all their free time learning about the nuances of hypothermia. And because it's not a curriculum, they end up spending too much time, I feel, becoming very good at a small niche at the expense of the basics.
Well, you know, it is true that FOAM is not a curriculum yet, but I think it's coming. And I'm going to give a historical perspective to that comment, because the same thing could have been said about Journal Club. And this is a shout out to the people at McGill University and William Osler, who started Journal Club at McGill in response to how expensive it was to subscribe to journals. And so what he did was he would get one copy of the paper and then share it among the group for free. And it took place in a social setting or a club to encourage knowledge translation. And, you know, to me, that sounds a lot like FOAM, you know, the free component without the electronic component to share educational material amongst a group of interested learners.
I'll take your historical analogy and I'll bring it a little bit to the modern era. When we were, I guess I'll tackle it like this. The fact that a paper is being written about something suggests that it's still up for research or still controversial in some way or is about to change how we do things. But there's plenty of things that we do that aren't being researched that actively, or maybe they should be, but they're kind of settled. And this goes back to Joe Lex's original dictum. If you want to learn how medicine was practiced 5 years ago, read a textbook. Well, if you're a true FOMED enthusiast, if you've taken it way too far, then all you're learning about is the stuff that's changed in the past year or so, the stuff that's being discussed in journals, the stuff that's being discussed on Twitter, and you're not learning the stuff about how we practiced 5 years ago. And not everything we do has changed in the last 5 years. There's plenty of stuff that we need to know that hasn't changed.
Nick, there are some FOAM resources that aren't the cutting edge sexy stuff. And in fact, another Canadian resource, and it's called Boring EM. Yeah. And it's the boring stuff. Brent is doing a great job with Boring EM, talking about the boring, basic, fundamental stuff of emergency medicine.
Yeah, and I salute him. And he's been trying to recruit people to fill out that curriculum. And let's see how that goes. I feel like if you start asking people to talk about or lecture about or write about something that they're not passionate about, they're going to consider it work. And they're going to want to get paid for it or get reimbursed for it in some way. And then you're going to have to tell these faculty members and these experts in their field, like, why should you contribute to Boring EM when you can write a chapter for Tintinelli or for Rosie? I mean, that's and then get the recognition from your chair and the accolades from your peers that you might not get from contributing to Boring EM.
I hear you, but there I have another example, and that's EM Basics with Steve Carroll, and he's out of the U.S. And, you know, he's covering medical students and residents' core content, emergency medicine, for free.
I salute them, and I want them to succeed. When the residents start quoting me those podcasts, then I'll know that they've arrived.
Okay. I'm going to get back to the Journal Club concept, just because, you know, it was not considered a curriculum when it started, but it was a unique answer to a common problem, the expense of subscribing to journals. But it became a core curriculum at many schools. Do you have a Journal Club at your school?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, and so when it first came out, it was sort of like, what are these guys doing? What is this? And it wasn't a core curriculum. It was just some people getting together to discuss a paper. And now it's slowly been integrated into a core curriculum. And so I think that this is where social media and FOAM is possibly heading in a similar fashion, that people get together and do this. I don't know. Are you aware of any groups using podcasts, blogs, or Twitter as a core part of their curriculum?
Well, we were for a time at Mount Sinai, and like I say, we were giving residents 1 hour's worth of conference credit each week to listen to podcasts and then write up a summary. But I believe that program is stopped.
So if anybody out there has a resource or ideas that are using podcast, blog, or Twitter as core curriculum, I'd love to hear about it. So just put it up on the comment section in the blog so everybody can benefit and Nick can know about it.
I promise I will tweet about whatever resources get shared.
Now, you've mentioned a few times the obvious, you know, that we all have finite time, and you think trainees' times would be better spent on more traditional forms of education. I sort of take a view of that FOAM offers a great way to leverage some of your time, you know, turning your car into a classroom or, you know, going for a workout and stuff. You live in New York. You must commute, right?
I do. I take the subway.
And is it a 20, 30-minute subway ride trip?
It's usually a little bit less. But the point is, it's kind of a captive environment where, you know, I can either stare at my feet or I can listen to something educational.
So I think that sort of a nice way so that you can fit a podcast into your commute to augment your learning, not exclusively, but to augment. And then certainly, you know, people have talked to me about using it when they're working out and certainly exercising your brain while staying physically active. I mean, emergency medicine is a very stressful specialty and does take its toll. And we need to take care of ourselves. So why not go out for a run and listen to a podcast? Now I have to caution you. I would not recommend listening to Smart EM by David Newman for a run unless you bring some fluids, because it's going to turn out to be a 10-mile run for an hour and a half.
But I think human nature being what it is, it's very tempting, and it's certainly something I've fallen victim to myself, that after listening to a particularly good episode of SGEM or some other podcast, I lull myself into thinking I have done my share of reading for the week, or I have learned something new today and I don't need to do any more. And then I focus on all the other things in my inbox that need to be done. And sometimes, I'm a big fan of E.M. Lit of Note, Ryan Radesky's blog. And I've caught myself just reading that blog and not even following the links, not even seeing what paper he's discussing, and just kind of saying, well, now I feel up to date on this topic, I can move on to something else. And we need to be vigilant so that that doesn't become – so we don't erode our critical thinking skills, and we don't start taking shortcuts.
Well, you did say that experienced physicians could overdose on any educational material, yeah. And perhaps the FOAM community will need to come up with some kind of 12-step program to address the few physicians that OD on FOAM. And I'll be there saying, hi, my name is Ken. And I'm addicted to FOAM. Hi, Ken. I mean, I think it's admitting you have a problem is one of the first steps. And we wouldn't want to prevent anybody from going into DTs or delirium Twitter. So your conclusion is somewhat positive, though, saying that FOAM is a good way to get up to speed. And it's fun and it's interactive with leaders and it's easy. But ironically, without FOAM, listeners to this podcast would not be able to get up to speed, have fun, and interact with leaders like you. And you caution that we run the risk of losing our critical faculties and broad understanding of emergency medicine. And of course, be sure to be skeptical and have an open mind. I mean, not so open that your brain falls out. But we're talking about adults and adult education. So do you think the majority of physicians will overdose on FOAM?
I do not.
Good.
But like I said, it is, especially for this whole thing, this whole pro-con piece originated because we were trying to communicate something to our readers and hopefully your listeners as well. When they hear about FOAM and they want to know, what's the deal with it? Is it something I need to be following? I don't think it's something that's essential to emergency medicine education. It's nice. It's a beautiful adjunct. It has a lot of great qualities. I think you can still be a great doctor without FOAM. And that's the only point I wanted to make.
I think that the evidence suggests that it is very difficult, with all the publications that come out every day. Mm-hmm. It's very expensive and it's very time consuming to be an excellent physician without FOAM. And FOAM just represents a tool. And I always just point to the knowledge translation problem, that we know that this traditional method fakes takes far too long for high-quality, clinically relevant, evidence-based information to reach the patient bedside. And one definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different outcome. And I don't want it to take 10 years. So I think that adding as an adjunct, why not try foam in moderation?
I think that's a fair thing to say. I can't argue with that.
So that covers much of what your column discussed, I think, about how foam is not essential to emergency medicine education. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up before we finish?
I think traditionally we would end a talk like this or a conversation or an article like this with some good references and some good resources for follow-up. And you mentioned a few already.
Okay, so I'll make sure I put some stuff in the show notes for that. And so we finish up the podcast traditionally with a Keener contest. And last week's winner was Maya Tuta, and she's a registered nurse from Hamilton, Ontario. So congratulations to Maya, who knew that the Boston Marathon runs through the town of Framingham. It's the famous study that was started in 1948 looking for cardiac risk factors. And on Monday, I got to run through Framingham giving Levine sign, clutching my chest.
Oh, very, very well done. Very nice. I hope there were some bubbles waiting for you at the end of the trip.
I've got a Keener contest for this week, and it involves social media, and it looks back at social media as not a new thing. And the social media question, or the Keener question for this week is, well, Gutenberg was credited with inventing the printing press in Europe around 1450. What nation developed the movable type printing technology hundreds of years earlier than Gutenberg? If you know the answer, just send it to me at thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line, and I will send you a cool skeptical prize. And in fact, Nick, you've been so gracious to come on and defend your con position when it comes to FOMED that I will be sending you a cool skeptical prize as always.
Okay, I hope that doesn't lead to a conflict of interest that I have to report.
No, I don't think so. I won't have to put some kind of disclaimer on the podcast. And next week, I will be back to the usual critical appraisal format. And the topic, just to give a teaser, will be on blood pressure targets for intracranial hemorrhage, with the theme being, how low can you go? Nick, thanks so much for doing the show and being part of the foam movement and being skeptical, even of foam. Would you do me the honor of giving the Skeptic's Guide tagline?
Be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.